Focus now on the Land Forces Expo, held at the Melbourne Convention Centre from the 11th to the 13th of September. We hear first from Senior Lecturer at RMIT University, Binoy Campmark. I began with a comment, a ring of steel protecting the masters of war.
Well, yes, it was remarkable to see the incredible contrast between on the one hand, protesters wanting to make the point about the absurd spectacle of a huge arms fair gathering taking place at the Melbourne Convention Centre between September 11th and September 13th, a conference underwritten, I should add, by the Victorian Labour government and with facilities and all the benefits and the fripperies and whatnot, and that these particular individuals who'd come out to protest were treated with the disdain and with brute force by heavily armed police personnel, and there was even some personnel that had been called in from New South Wales to bolster this ring of steel. Having also seen the site myself, it was an extraordinary thing. You had several layers on, up to Batman Park, where you had police mounted and horses, of course. You also had very heavily armed riot police, with the full gear, armed with pepper spray, armed with rubber bullets. It was quite a astonishing and frightening sight. And don't forget the surveillance that was in place, the use of multiple drones and the use of helicopters and so forth. We were confronted by this bizarre sense that the individuals who were protesting were the ones deemed to be the terrorists and the rabble-rousers and the problem makers, rather than the ones in the building of the convention center, plotting and making deals to sell weapons, manufacture weapons, and contract out weapons to kill people. So it was quite an extraordinary inversion of the standard notion about what constitutes extremism or what constitutes a disruption to peace.
And when you think about who was in that convention center and the mayhem, the destruction, the war, the genocide, that they're part of, yet our government has this armory against the people who are protesting against the killing that these masters of war, as I said before, are contributing to.
There was a very disturbing irony in having a taxpayer-funded conference or some, arms expo with taxpayer-funded police supposedly meant to protect the public being deployed against tax-paying protesters. It is one of the most perverse inversions, as I said before, that you could imagine. And it also, was also telling that there was no sense of openness or transparency about it at all, about the gathering. There was the way of accessing it was virtually impossible unless you were either a member of the Merchants of Death Club, as I like to call it, or you were accredited member of the press and so forth. So there was virtually little in terms of actual coverage about the nature about what was being done. And of course, it was being done. It was very obvious. It was merchandise being sold that has been trained on not just the people of Gaza, but is used in virtually every conflict zone and spreads mayhem in terms of preventing peace from taking place. So the amoral nature of it was just astonishing to behold.
And as an activist said to me yesterday, the fact that those people in that convention centre are actually working out better ways for the police to control the population too, with the weapons that they're arming the police with.
Well, yes, because the nature of weaponry is that it has no obvious volition and no sentience. It will be used and adopted by whoever purchases them. The nature of it is that profit is the central motivation of arms companies, and they don't give a sod as to who and what and whatever entity purchases them. This includes police forces and globally who will use whatever merchandise is available to obviously suppress or to control populations. And it's been very evident that that's the case. And an example you know, Elbit Systems was present, for example. We know that Elbit Systems is responsible for arming the Israeli military with drones that have been used on the Palestinians. We also know that Elbit Systems, the nature of that technology, has then been used in other areas of surveillance and control. Now, there's no moral context about it. It can be used to monitor populations for reasons of, as per a project that was pursued by Elbit Systems' Australian counterpart in Melbourne a few years ago. It could be used in the context of dealing with, evacuations or in the face of bushfires or whatnot. But the reality is that the technology creeps into other spaces of life and is used in many detrimental ways as well. So, yes, be it policing, be it suppression, be it the authoritarian, whatever the regime is, it might be an authoritarian government, it might be a supposedly liberal democratic government, but the principles is the same.
And what's been revealed in the last little while is the fact that a number of these companies are and have been embedded in universities for quite a while.
Yes, it's one of those disconcerting things, and certainly from my perspective, given the fact that I am, as it were, in the business of educating students, as it were, on that particular line. It's incredibly disconcerting to find the extent that the military-industrial complex has embedded itself in the education complex, if you like. And it's also, it should also be added that it crosses a range of areas. It's investment. The investment portfolio of universities, for example, heavily features the likes of Raytheon and the likes of British Aerospace and so forth. But then in addition to that, let's not forget the growth of programs that are directly linked to gathering, let's call them budding militarists and encouraging the goodness of participating in the arms industry. And unfortunately, the advent of AUKUS has accelerated this dramatically because the Albanese government has promised upwards of 4,000 Commonwealth-funded positions in what they call STEM. So it's a hijacking of technology, essentially, the heavy technology, mathematics, science, and engineering subjects. The idea is that, okay, well, no one's denying the importance of the STEM subjects. That's very important. But why on earth has it been hijacked in this way so that people who go into it are encouraged to essentially join in military endeavors? It should also be added that in addition to the 4,000 spots, not a day goes by, say not a month goes by perhaps, when not another announcement isn't made talking about student pathways, as they like to call it, leading students, for example, into ventures where they will see our weapons and they'll be participating in programs that will lead directly to recruitment for defense companies. So the crossover between public education and the crossover between educating in that sense and the private corporate machinery behind making arms has become so pronounced, and it's an incredibly disturbing thing. It's most advanced in places like the United States, but unfortunately in Australia you can really see it getting a kick along by virtue of such agreements as AUKUS and the desperation to recruit a civilian base here for essentially garrisoning Australia in the event of the next war.
And these STEM scholarships, what age group are they targeting? Is it late primary school or is it early secondary school?
It's a secondary school, these items. So we are talking about those heading into the upper, years 11 and 12. So they start in a sort of grade up to year 10, and then they, the idea is to get them then, studying these particular subjects within the school system and in anticipation then of applying for positions at universities. So the nature of the, so I think if I'm not mistaken, one of the federal programs envisages $5.1 million being channeled into a pathways program between, I think, WA, Western Australia and South Australia, which is no surprise given the, of course, the fact that WA has bases which are connected with the submarines, and obviously in South Australia, it's meant to be the construction front for the as yet fictional AUKUS submarine, nuclear powered submarine. So money is being put into that, and these are targeting high school students.
What's the role within that convention centre of the state government, apart from facilitating the conference happening, what are the parliamentarians actually up to within the conference?
Well, what is interesting is that it's very clear that the Victorian government has been very actively promoting the know-how, so to speak, of Australian manufacturing. And in fact, you can tell from the statements being made by various Victorian politicians that they see or have seen the convention, the expo, essentially, as a good chance to advertise Australian potential, if you like, military potential or military worth. So it's very clear that they've been involved. And what I find very interesting is you can also tell the vehement nature of the denials or the repudiation of the role played by, for example, the Greens in the protests by the Labour government and also the opposition by condemning the Greens for actually marching and turning up in the protests. It's extraordinary to see again this total reversal of perspective that you have the Premier Jacinta Allen making what can only be seen as a grotesque remark or statement that these people that is being, gathering at the convention centre, these are people engaged in a peaceful endeavour. So she actually used the remark, which I thought was remarkable in itself, that those gathering to protest against it were the anarchists and the ones creating disorder, whereas those inside the building, in the convention centre, were the ones engaged in peaceful assembly. I could barely believe it when I saw the statement. It was remarkable.
And of course, the police minister said similar words as well.
Yes, the police minister has said, in fact, ahead of time was already making threats, drawing the line and saying that protesters would be looked at very carefully, with a withering gaze and so on. And actually, it's interesting on that point, now that you mentioned the police minister, it should also be noted that the zone of exclusion, this declared zone around the area of the convention centre, was also done in breach of the government's own regulations. The government has this, and unfortunately, it's a law that's developed since 2009, which is very oddly tagged on to a weapons regulation law of the state of Victoria that dates from 1990. But the 2009 law gives the police commissioner powers to declare a zone of an area and the environs of the area, which gives police extraordinary powers of search, detention and removal, which is remarkable. But notwithstanding that, what is fascinating is that within the law itself, there are also restrictions such as 12 hours, that the zone can only apply for 12 hours. Now, I can tell you something. Those zones did not apply for just 12 hours in the course between September 11th and September 13th. So legal advocates and activist groups have condemned the use of these kind of declared powers in the past, but we saw them in full use on this occasion in a most dastardly way.
And these new powers and new laws are never or very seldom rescinded after the event?
No, this is exactly it. They expand, and once they've expanded and then bloated, and once they've calloused, as it were, on the body politic, politicians are always reluctant to remove them because they give enormous latitude to the powers of enforcement. And it means that they can be used against any type of protest. It doesn't even matter, any type of control of the population. And that's why, the nature of these prohibitions is just astonishing and what can be done. And also the minimal justifications. It's purely reliant in the eye of the policing authority as to whether they're justified or not. And that makes it very contentious. It's virtually impossible to challenge these in the court. It's virtually impossible to challenge the legality of these particular executive measures in a court of law, because the laws are so broadly drafted and the discretion given to the executive is enormous. It should also be added that, and this is another thing that's very disconcerting, is that Victorian parliamentarians, including members of the government when the 2009 laws were, which were the ones being used between September 11th and 13th, they even they acknowledged that those laws were in contrary to the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities of Victoria, and they were incompatible. So we have an open admission by Victoria's politicians that these regulations, these special emergency powers, if you like, are incompatible with the Charter. So that's, it's again, another state, it's a horrendous state of affairs.
And it seems that they can always find a compliant judge to bring these laws into being.
Yes, and you know, to be fair, the judges really don't seem to have they don't have much in terms of enforcement on this point. The Charter is fairly limited in many ways in terms of what it can be used for. The judges can always make recommendations and say that the particular law is inconsistent, but the courts of Victoria are not given full powers of invalidation when it comes to these things. So no Victorian judge is going to go out and openly say, I mean, they might say, for example, that the measure is not compliant, but they have no powers to then say, well, the measure is illegal and therefore should be rescinded. And that makes it very difficult.
Just finally, Binoy, it's coming up to a year of genocide in Gaza, and the situation in the West Bank deteriorates day by day. Yet at this convention, there were major Israeli war manufacturers, masters of war or weapons manufacturers. And one of them was being interviewed, I think it was either the ABC or SBS, saying in words, not quite this, but similar, I wouldn't have missed it.
Yes, this is precisely it. These gatherings are precisely what they are. They are gatherings of, to use that expression that I used earlier, merchants of death. The phrase comes famously from a report of proceedings that took place in 1934 that were instituted by Senator Gerald Nye, a rather known North Dakota senator who investigated or was part of a committee investigating the reasons why the United States ended up joining the First World War, and his interests, the role of arms companies. And these fairs, what they do is they facilitate wars, they encourage it. It's said, you know, Anton Chekhov has this wonderful line, and this is Notes to Playwrights. He says that, you know, if you put a loaded gun on a stage, it's going to be used. If you have people gathering at a convention center, talking about armaments, talking about sale, talking about advertising them, they're there for one fundamental reason, that these will be used. And the excitement that they cause with themselves, the tittering and the excitement that they have with making these deals, is actually quite sickening. But it is the normalization of killing. And we see it from, you know, Gaza, we see it to Sudan, we see it all across the conflict zones of the world. And these are the people who profit from the misery of others. And that's something that should really be called out constantly.
Thank you, Binoy. We do our best.
Yes, absolutely, Jan. Okay, you take care and we'll talk soon.
I was speaking there with Dr. Binoy Campmark, Senior Lecturer at RMIT University. Next to anti-war activist, researcher and broadcaster Jacob Grech. And here he explains why he wasn't able to participate in the protests and demonstrations at the Melbourne Convention Centre.
Well, unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond my control, which basically revolve around recent death of a very, very dear friend, I have to be in southern New South Wales to deal with the things you deal with when someone passes away.
Where do you see protests like this, or is there another way to protest against these warmongers?
The protests are a very integral, very necessary part of the campaign against the masters of war. There are a whole lot of things that need to be done, and there are a whole lot of ways we could oppose them. And protests are a major way. For, just as an example, if it wasn't for the protests, the word would not have got out that this weapons convention was happening in Melbourne, firstly, and secondly, that it was contentious and there was a significant number of people in Melbourne and across Australia who were unhappy that this kind of profiteering from the deaths of millions of people all around the world was going on. So the protests are absolutely essential. And I want to give big props to the people who did turn out to the protests and who put themselves on the line. I know my own crew were there in numbers and have been on the phone to me and through social media to me, telling me about the emotional effects and the physical effects. We've had people who were knocked sideways by flashbang bombs, OC sprayed, hit with rubber bullets, searched and numerous times, driving in and out of the city, and just basically brutalized by the Victorian police force. And I want to give big props to the protest. But one thing that has concerned me, and this is not a criticism, this is my own fault and the fault of the whole peace movement, is that there was a lack of depth in the opposition to the conference. Where were the unions? Where were the churches? Where were the social justice organisations? It's a problem that I think we in the peace movement need to have a good, long, hard look at and start the process of rebuilding, and why these people weren't involved or aren't involved, and how we facilitate them becoming involved. And I think that should be a big project for the remainder of the year. And it's not just a Land Forces conference. We've seen it with a whole lot of reasons for the lack of that kind of depth in the campaigns, in the protests that have been taking place for Gaza. And I think it's something we really need to have a look at in the lead up to the anniversary rally for Gaza on the 6th of October, and also in the lead up to the Avalon Air Show, which is coming up in March, which is, 6-7 months away.
You're saying there's a whole lot of other ways to approach this issue. What are some of them?
The unions, for example, need to step up and start educating their members about what they're doing in these industries. In previous times, with previous campaigns against war, the unions have played a major role. You would remember the Victorian Peace Network, for example, just in Melbourne in, well, I was going to say recent times, but 20 years ago now. And going back, we need to look at some of the strategies that trade unions have took for the rediversion of spending, the conversion towards production of more socially beneficent products. And I think in order to do that, we need to start understanding that the reasons behind the arms industry explosion in Australia. I mean, it'd be easy to believe that the arms industry is exploding just because our leaders are psychopaths and want to get involved in all the whiz-bang weaponry to kill people with. But it's a lot more, and we're seeing that because of the depth of the movement, because of the lack of analysis, I guess, we're seeing that in a whole lot of things of people just wanting the arms companies to go. But it's there are actually very important economic drivers to the arms industry that have to do with free trade agreements and the economic complexity and international laws around the free trade agreements and trade laws that we need to address if we're going to have a real meaningful impact into the way our national economy is being diverted towards fulfilling the requirements of global capital's need for war. Some of you listeners would remember and be aware of the big campaigns against free trade agreements that towards the end of last century and the beginning of this century. Geez, that makes us sound old. But the GATT rounds and all the World Trade Organization protests that were going on. What happened is Australia needed, economically speaking, and within the framework of global capital, to secure markets for its primary resources. Now, this came about for a whole lot of other reasons, but how far do we want to go back? But in order to do that, we entered trade agreements that meant that we'd guarantee metal resources extraction and agriculture. And to guarantee those markets, we agreed not to subsidise our manufacturing industries. Like there used to be tariffs on vehicles, for imported vehicles, for example. Now, what this led to was the end of the automotive industry in Australia. And that's not just me saying it. This is that's recognised as this is why we have no automotive industry in Australia, because of the free trade agreements. Now, the automotive industry was not just the big factories of Ford and Holden and the rest of them. It was the flow-on factories. I mean, many years ago, I worked for a short time in a foundry that just made gear cogs for one of the gearbox manufacturers who then sold on to Ford. All those industries were in danger of dying. And that, in turn, led to a problem where, as our manufacturing industry was dying and our export to manufactured goods basically ended, we had no depth to the economy. It's what's called economic complexity. You know, we used to be, while we had an automotive industry here up until, say, the early 90s in particular, we had a very complex economy. Some of our money come from resources, some come from, you know, wool, of course, but we also had, as well as tourism and education, manufactured goods that were being sold around the country, around the world. This no longer happens, which means that our economy is reliant on primary production exports, which means that we're open to the fluctuations in that market. Now, as I say, we used to be about, you know, in the 30s of the rank of economic complexity in the world. At the moment, we're at number 93. You know, we're on a par with Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Zambia and places that we would see as not necessarily, you know, in the same rank of first world countries that Australia likes to kid itself. It's similar to. We see ourselves as similar to Canada and Western Europe, the United States and the rest of it. Now, in order to guard against the attacks on our economy, the Australian government and Australian industry needs to rebuild our manufacturing base. This is just economics 101. We need to rebuild our manufacturing industries. However, because of all the free trade agreements, we can't make cars, we can't make white goods, we can't make tools. We can make basically nothing. The only thing we can make to develop our manufacturing industry is weapons. And that's because weapons are exempt from free trade agreements under what's called national security exemption clauses. This is why we're doing it. Sure, there's a bit of psychopathy in the government that wants to be involved in all these military adventurisms and all the rest of it. Sure, it's to do with our place as a sub-imperial power to global capital in the region. But I don't think we as a protest movement are, explaining the drivers of the arms industry and what is happening to the Australian economy and the kind of bind that governments of both persuasions find themselves in a effort to rebuild our manufacturing sector. I think we need to get that message out so that people, once you understand why something is happening, you have a better understanding of what can be done to stop it happening, in my view.
I still don't understand, Jacob, why it had to be war. I know you're saying they get dispensation or whatever, but with the free trade, but did it have to go toward supporting wars and, as we're seeing now, genocide? And the fact that the governments don't even acknowledge what's happening to countries like Gaza.
Oh, absolutely. And look, I'm not exonerating our governments and our politicians and saying, bad luck, folks, we have no choice. I mean, after all, these are the same politicians and the same governments that signed us up to all these agreements because they were feathering their nests and only and looking no further than the next election. I'm not exonerating them at all. I'm saying this is what they've done, but this is how and why they've done it. The global capitalist economy, I don't think would be any surprise to you or most of your listeners, is predicated on war. War is the ultimate expression of capitalism. I mean, this is what socialists and anarchists have been saying for more than 100, well, probably close to a couple of hundred years now. If you're going to base an economy on extraction of resources and pillage of the planet, then that is inexorably going to lead to war. That's why it's happening.
And then there's the issue also, which has been happening for quite a while now, the politicians, when they retire from Parliament, they very quickly and smoothly move over to take high positions in manufacturers of war machines.
Absolutely, because they have the networks, they have the contacts. They often don't do much, but they enable the companies to say, oh, look, we've got a former Minister of Defence on our board. We've got the former Minister for Foreign Affairs or Defence Industry or Industry or Education on our board. It's a badge of honour to them to basically prove how close they are to our government. But it also enables those people with their own networks and their own leverage, and people who are politicians have a lot of say and a lot of sway, ex-politicians have a lot of sway in the younger members of their political parties who are often mentored by them. But it's not just politicians. It's senior public service. It's the heads of the Department of Defence. It's the head of the Navy, the chief of the Air Force, the chief of the Army, the Joint Command Chief. They all move, all those military people move towards working for arms companies. It's called the revolving door. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard of it. And again, in a capitalist framework, if you were the head of the military in Australia for many years, and Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or someone else come up to you, Elbit, and said, look, all you need to say is you're be on our board of directors. We'll give you a few grand and put you up and show you good time 4 times a year when we have a quarterly general meeting, and we'll use your face and your name, and for all that, you'll get $1 million a year. Why wouldn't you if you had no morals? And I think we accept that these people have no morals.
I'd like to look at another side of it, and that's the impact on our society and the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. With the militarisation of the police, even the mainstream media is calling it a ring of steel against these dreadful protesters.
Yeah, well, that's having a huge impact. Like, the protests on Wednesday were quite large. The protests yesterday were a lot smaller. And I think, and I know, people who were planning on going on Thursday who just decided it was too dangerous to go in after what happened to them and what they saw happen to others on the Wednesday. I think that was the police tactic. And everywhere they're trying to, what's the word, close the what's called the Overton window, the window of topics and positions that can be discussed, say, in polite society, so that they're moving the discussion we're having towards their side. And that's what they're doing by using things like violent protests. But I think anybody who watches the news reports, and I've watched snippets of the mainstream media, I urge them just to watch it again, but turn the sound down so you're not getting the overlay. From the police side, from the government side, even from the protester side, and just use your own eyes to see what's happening. They're trying to quell dissent. And I also want to point out something I think that's very important, is that while this is called land forces and it's primarily about the military, there are many, many companies in there who also provide equipment to the police forces around the world. While I was talking to someone on the phone yesterday, there was a sound of a chopper in the air, and that chopper is a Victorian police helicopter, used one of the most high-tech surveillance helicopters in the world when they were built, when they were bought, I think 3 or 4 years ago, to surveil and act as a command and control unit in the sky against the protesters. Those helicopters were made by a company called Leonardo that used to be called Finmeccanica, that started life as the prototype factory that Mussolini used to institute his fascist industrial state. Okay, so these companies, they're not only supporting the military, they're supporting police forces. The companies that build, that make the OC spray, that build the flashbang weapons, that make the rubber bullets, Nioa, a Queensland company whose father, the owner of who, Robert Nioa, his father-in-law is Bob Catter, surprise, surprise, they're all in there as well. And they're not just selling to the military. They're selling to police forces and private security organisations. And in some ways, I hate to say it, but it's always the way. We can't avoid it. There would be people from other police forces looking at the footage of the protests that happened in Melbourne over the last few days and seeing it as a demonstration on how their products are being used.
What disturbs me is the fact that universities were represented at that expo.
Yeah, universities are getting bigger and bigger and bigger into the military, and this is because of the military industrial complexes and stranglehold, or basically on our whole society. There's one thing I was just looking at as an example. Just look at, and this is just some research I was doing the other day, right? You look at Deakin University, and Deakin University has what they call a carbon cluster, where research is undertaken on carbon composites. Now, one of the companies that was involved from day one in that carbon cluster is a mob called Quickstep. Now, they're the fourth largest defence or military exporter from Australia. In the last financial year, they exported, let me have a look, $63.2 million worth of equipment overseas. But Quickstep do their research within the hallowed grounds of Deakin University. They designed the lightweight composites that go into drones, and they designed a drone, which they then went into partnership with a mob called Carbonix, who work out of Artarmon in Sydney, who are manufacturing drones and have just received a contract to provide drones to an American company called Argentech, which is run by US veterans, and they boast that they provide unmanned aerial vehicles and embed itself with troops flying missions for not only the US Department of Defense and NATO, but for other foreign military customers. So when you put all those little stories together, you get a situation where Deakin University students, chemistry and engineering students, are working on composites that are eventually being used by American mercenaries for other foreign military customers. It's worse than we think it is, Jan.
That's the problem, isn't it? We don't know enough.
Well, I'd like to say, to finish off, that while Land Forces is over, the continuation of Australia's push into the arms industry, and it's not just Australia, it's Victoria, the state governments as well play a big role in this. The state governments and battle each other to get these companies to produce the stuff here rather than Queensland or SA or WA. So it's a ridiculous type of internal competition. But the campaign continues. Coming up in March next year, there's the Avalon Air Show, which is also an arms trade fair. In the lead up to that, I think it's important, I think it's imperative. This is not to cast any shade on people who are doing everything they and we are doing at the moment, but I think it's just shown that there is a lack of depth of understanding that we're putting out in society. And I think it's imperative on us to build a campaign to include the unions and the churches and the social justice groups to let people know what is going on. And once they know what's going on, then move to the next step of changing things.
And thanks to Jacob Greg, researcher, broadcaster, and anti-war activist. And you can hear more of Jacob on 3CR every Friday at 5 p.m. with the Friday Rave.